Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg, and Andre Kleiner's on the line. Hey, Andre.
Hey, Fred.
Well, this is our
good take.
Good to be back. Yeah, I understand you were you were in Europe, weren't you, on a recent trip?
Yeah, the same time as you were at Rams. So, yeah, it's good to get back together.
Yeah, it is. And you missed a good conference. We had a good time there. We got to talk to a lot of folks and catch up a bunch and promote the Ascendo Reliability and the podcast, things like that. So that was all fun. And, you know, got to see a couple really nice presentations and a few that I wasn't too impressed by. Good content.
As always, yeah.
Yeah. We're not the best of presenters in general as engineers.
That's called variation.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's right.
You have both tails of that distribution. That's,
definitely.
That's expected.
We had picked this topic where we wanted to talk about design for reliability a little bit. And I just got off the phone with one of my clients, and it's frustrating is that anytime the reliability plan was basically really focused on features, and it is a pretty feature rich product and pushing the envelope of what's possible. And in those regards, the design team is basically inventing as they go, and it's pretty clever, the product they're putting together. Unfortunately, things like derating or verifying assumptions about reliability, even breaking it down to, well, how good does the ASIC have to be? You know, just simple reliability block diagrams and apportionment really seems to have fallen by the wayside underneath the weight of getting a functional product at the edge of technology put together.
Yeah, and I think that's where we come in because, yes, you're absolutely right. Many industries facing the same problem. The design teams are focusing on functionality, and that's their main goal. But they kind of everything related to reliability is kind of byproduct or a secondary thought.
Well, you also see it with companies that are doing cost-sensitive products. So a consumer product, and they're trying to hit a particular cost target. They look at reliability activity as increasing the costs, the bill of material costs. So if I have to use a more robust capacitor, it takes more space and it costs more. And that's contrary to their primary goal. So it's functionality or cost or even time to market are common focuses for teams that reliability certainly can help. The hard part is that it's not immediate. It's harder to measure right away.
I tell you, in the automotive industry, and I think we've made a lot of progress as far as design for reliability. But at the same time, again, we still kind of tend to go back to this TAAF, test, analyze, and fix approach. I occasionally do trainings, reliability trainings for design teams. And I kind of keep emphasizing that when we get to what's called DV, design validation, it's not the time to find the problems with the product.
Oh, definitely.
Once you get to validation phase, you basically expect, you should expect the product to pass, not to find problems with it. And that's still the message which kind of sometimes gets stuck somewhere and doesn't make it to
Well, there's plenty of pressures, right? The first prototypes there's customers that want to get their hands on it. There's marketing wants it. The software team needs it. The mechanical, electrical engineers want to get it on their bench to see if their decisions were correct. And we're ready to throw it into a chamber and destroy it. It's going to be a consistent battle. I think the problem is conveying how important reliability is so that it becomes part of the design process. And that that's not always an easy message to get across. It's easier if the product, in the last generation had a major problem. I think Samsung now with their cell phone division is going to really pay attention to reliability.
Oh, yeah, after that battery thing.
That's
yeah.
right. But we don't really need to wait until we have a disaster to understand that reliability is important. It's conveying that message early on. And, the hard part I've always found, Andre, is that we're saying it's like selling insurance. If we invest now, we avoid problems in the future. And if everything works, we don't have any problems. There's no excitement. There's no change. Everything works as expected.
Yeah, it's kind of expected. It's like if you have a missing tooth, everybody sees it. But if you all your teeth are in place, I mean, nobody notices. Oh yeah, this guy has all teeth in place.
Yeah, it doesn't raise to a consciousness. So part of our challenge, and it applies to quality and reliability, and a number of these other things, that if it just works, it's no big deal. Is wait a second, it really, really is. The last five products we launched, we had, 10% failure rates, and it cost us millions of dollars in warranty and all these things. And this product comes out and it's at 2% defect rate, and we're only paying a fraction of warranty, and our profit is up. Yeah. Now, isn't that worth noticing?
You're absolutely right. And sometimes the best way to explain the importance is through actually the financial side of it, mm-hmm. Dollars and cents. And I can tell you where we got some success kind of conveying this message to our management, upper management, because we, as I mentioned before, we have this DV design validation thing.
Right.
And what happened when we find problems or something goes wrong or design changes, we actually have to repeat the validation. And in fact, we kind of making a big deal out of all the money and resources spent on what we call DV2, right. DV3, DV4.
Right.
Believe it or not, sometimes it gets there. And actually, we also have PV, which stands for product or process validation. Mm-hmm. Either way works. Where it's basically we're testing for product readiness, and sometimes you also have to do PV2, PV3, and we, like I said, we have some success showing dollars and cents to the upper management and saying, okay, we need to do design for reliability so we can avoid all this cost even before the product gets to the field.
Mm-hmm. One technique is if you have a director of engineering that understands that they don't want to spend that money either, even though it's not from their budget, is their products are being delayed. Their engineers are being pulled from other activities to redesign something that they should have gotten right the first time. I think a combination of the management structure that understands that we need to pass DV the first time, and here's the tools and techniques to do it. The money approach helps the overall management team understands the importance of investing early. And it applies whether you're fighting cost or time to market or functionality. Yet what I find is that then the teams come back and say, well, what do we do different? And that's where the design for reliability, that's where, and there's many chapters in the product in the practical reliability engineering book that talks about things like FMEA and margin testing and stress strength calculations. And
oh, thanks for mentioning that. Yeah, in our book, Practical Reliability Engineering, in fact, we have a whole chapter 7, which is dedicated to design for reliability. And again, this is kind of our version of design for reliability, because if you ask 10 different people, what is design for reliability? You may get 10 different answers,
yeah.
But what would be the common is that you need to do things upfront, not when things start happening, basically when your products start failing.
And it's not rocket science, well, unless you're working on a rocket, I guess. But it's right. And it's basically is there margin? I mean, if there's, it's everything from setting tolerances to making sure it's manufacturable and you're not at the margins and have to inspect it in later and you have latent defects. But if you select a capacitor, for example, or a piece of metal to as a support bracket, does it have enough margin to accommodate the variability that you're going to expect to see? And if it doesn't, well, then that's not a... And designers inherently, I think, tend to understand that. It's just that there's so many components, so many pieces that it makes it difficult to cover all the bases without some step back and look at where the risks are, some prioritization work, some involvement to make sure that there's a structure in place to cover everything.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. It's not overly difficult thing, and in fact, you can explain design for reliability in those stress strength curves where you have on the left you have a distribution for stress, and on the right you have a distribution for strength of the product, and basically where all those distributions overlap, where like stress exceeds strength, then you have failures. Mm-hmm. It's a great concept. But once you get to details, they're like, okay, how do I determine what's the strength of my product? Then it gets a little more complicated.
That's
and
right.
Even determining what's the stress is also may not be that straightforward.
That's right.
But that's what our job is, to kind of help the design teams with that.
Well, one practice I've seen that was really informative for me was actually the marketing team. Created a manual basically for this product, family of products that the HP was designing, that said, well, here's where we expect these products to be used. Here's the expected temperature ranges and the distribution of temperatures, humidity, wind speed, vapor pressure and the air. They went through all these climatic type things, focused on where the customers actually lived. And there was a lot of coastal people, so things like salt concentrations in the air or air pollution factors. But they also included the details about use profile. It wasn't just people will print with this printer on occasion. It was, here's five different types of customers that have different printing profiles. And we knew that some things, if you used it a lot, it would cause failures in certain areas. And if you used it very infrequently, other areas would dominate in the failure mechanisms. But it gave us a very rich concept of what the stress profiles would be.
Yeah, and you have to look at this as, again, as a distribution. In the automotive industry, we call it pizza delivery guy who lives in rural area.
That's right. That's, does yeah, 200,000 miles a month, yeah, kind of thing.
Over like a gravel roads, and
that's right.
On the other end, we have a little old lady who drives her car on Sunday to a church, and that would be your other tale of the distribution.
That's right, and many designers, you know, they'll stop at saying, "Well, we're going to design for worst case," right? But
the question is, what is your worst case? I mean, is it something ever recorded in the past 2,000 years and on Earth?
That's
like
right.
If we talk about temperature, or you're going to be a little bit more practical and look at, let's say, 95th percentile severity on that distribution, or maybe 99th. I mean, we have customers who kind of demand different percentile distributions, but mm-hmm. It's usually between like 95th and 99th percentile user where you kind of have a reasonable coverage.
That's right.
Of your products and the users.
I had one customer that insisted that they run this high temperature, high humidity test over some period of time, and their products were used in hospitals. In North America, and the temperature that they wanted to do was 55 degrees C with a 90-95% humidity. And I'm okay. How many of your hospitals ever experience that extreme?
This kind of humidity,
for
yeah.
any period of time. And well, we did a survey, and there was New Delhi hospital that recorded it for 2 weeks, and you know, at these extreme temperatures and humidity. He says, "Well, your market's not in India," you know, and if it's one hospital worldwide that reports that, and you design for that, how much extra cost and, you know, materials and design effort you're putting into that versus how does your product, how is it used in North America and what leads to failures, that what's the risk for you? So sometimes that DFR process is, one, getting the information to do the stress profile. The other one is making sure that it's realistic, is that percentile is based on, as much as possible, your customers, as much as you can get that information. The other part is, where's the risk? What are you doing that is uncertain or unknown that we need better information, right? There's a whole nother realm to that is, a new vendor, a new manufacturing process, a new material, a new customer base. Usually when I hear the word new, that's when you start asking questions.
Yeah, you get alert a little bit. Yeah, I know. Yeah. And sometimes they wouldn't even tell you. It's like, oh, it's all the same. Yeah. Oh, by the way, manufacturing site is now in, I don't know, in India or Mexico, as opposed to some other place. And it's like, oh, why didn't you tell us that? Because, oh, it's all the same.
It's all the same. No, not really. No, I actually did a measurement on that. I never published it, but it was a manufacturing facility for multi-layer ceramic capacitors was in Japan, and we didn't have any issues with these capacitors. They just worked rock solid, and we heard that they were moving a manufacturing line to Vietnam. And they assured us that it was the same equipment. They were going to do a year's worth of training and bring up and all this stuff. So we took a reel from their Japanese plant and a reel from the Vietnamese plant and just measured them and got the distributions of them. Not only the Japanese plant was centered and like Six Sigma within the specifications, they were as close to identical capacitors as I thought was even possible to create. They're beautiful, right? And the Vietnamese group, not that there's anything wrong with the folks in Vietnam, and I'm sure they've learned and improved over the years, but they were bringing up a new plant and learning a new skill and what was important and not important. So the variability was beyond the specifications.
And it's expected.
And it wasn't centered at all. And it was like, here's the data, guys. This is why it's not the same.
And again, it takes us back to the stress strength concept where when we determine the stress, when we look at this distribution of temperatures and humidity and vibration and stuff you were talking before, and look at the tails. And at the same time, you look at your product and try to assess those variabilities and those you're talking about. Yeah, like a new plant. Or even design process. That all figures into this risk assessment and design for reliability.
Yeah. Well, so Andre, what do you think of design guidelines like derating curves or safety factor policies and the various things we hand to the design team, saying here's keep out regions on circuit boards and other guidelines that, you know, basically say, keep it conservative, or here's things we know are cause failures. Are those useful in your opinion?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have actually our own, we call them DDS, Delphi design standards.
Okay.
And we create them as we go, because this is basically where your lessons learned go to. Well, you say, oh, we had some problems with, I don't know, putting this capacitor in this location. So let's create a design standard which says, okay, don't do that.
Right. In HB, we had one for multi-layer ceramic capacitors and near the circuit board breakoff tabs. As you separate the individual boards in manufacturing, it would flex that board at that location enough to break capacitors. And so we would purposely move them further away from those breakoff tabs. And so we, you know, impose that in the board layout stage during the design before we ever manufactured one, and just avoided the problem altogether.
Yeah, some of the feedback we were getting from design teams is like, oh, it kind of limits our ability to do certain things.
It limits our creativity. I got that one time.
yeah. But again, if we're talking about mass production most of the industries where reliability is important, I think having design standards really kind of overweight this other concern because, again, it kind of comes back and bites you.
It does. And unfortunately, oftentimes we build those design standards based on lessons learned. There's plenty of good engineering knowledge out there, though. And we did that at HP as we surveyed our, you know, more senior engineers and folks with plenty of experience and said, you know, what are the design standards or guidelines that you typically use? And we codified those and used them as a series of notes. If you're going to use this polymer, here's things to be aware of. And just basically put those lessons learned or things to think about as you're designing. And then every 3-4 years, we spent the time to update those because materials change and our use of the materials have changed. It was really hard to avoid repeating mistakes. And so we reinforced the use of those design standards in order to minimize the repeated mistakes kind of issues.
Yeah, and it's also important when you have new people coming to design teams and, young engineers. And it's especially important in regions where you have high turnover, like, for example, in China, there's really high turnover because they keep growing and basically they every few years people go somewhere and get like 10-20% raise and mm-hmm. go work for someone else. And you get new people all the time, and that's where having design standards and established practices is doubly important.
That's right. So it's a combination, really. It's one is the culture has to place an importance on designing reliability into the product and not relying on design verification or other style of testing to signal if you have a problem or not. That's really expensive just to redo the testing, or that it's too late and you ship it and you know you have problems. On the other hand, then where we come in is then helping to create those design standards, whether it's a derating guideline or a lessons learned, sets of information about materials or components. But it's part of it is it's important, and the other part is enabling people with the information they need so they can make good decisions during the design process.
Yeah, and one other thing, as far as applications of design for reliability, as I mentioned before, I train design engineers on basics of reliability. Mm-hmm. And one thing we always emphasize is do what we call verification testing, mm-hmm. which is well before official validation. So if you have any concerns with anything, just come back to us and we'll vibrate your unit or put it through, high temperature or temperature cycling. If you have any concerns, please do not wait till DV or PV especially, because then it's basically too late and everybody's going to suffer.
That's right.
And again, this is kind of takes some doing to change that kind of mentality. And because we all know if they come back for verification for that testing, it's going to save us money in the future.
Oh, definitely. The other part is that we had one division that the senior managers would provide additional management oversight to an engineer that was in charge of a part that failed in that last round of verification. And it was a not something any of the engineers wanted. So they came to us to get that early work done. If they had any hint, they did not want to be the guy that got the extra attention late in the program. they really didn't want the extra unwanted oversight. And so they went to great lengths to make sure that they would pass all of the ending tests. And it worked. We rarely ever passed the final round of verification. It became a challenge when we wanted to do cost reduction. And since we'd been passing all these tests for so long, how do we keep the designers motivated to design to pass the test, even if the test doesn't exist anymore? But I think that's a subject for another discussion.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. All right. Well, so anyway, let us know if you're listening to this and you've got that challenge of how to convince your organization to design in reliability, to use design for reliability practices. You know, let us know what the challenges you're seeing are and what kind of issues you're facing. Andre and I can certainly provide some hints and tips and probably make for another show or two based on the comments we get. But also, if you have a successful program, what made the difference? We'd love to hear from you, and we could certainly share best practices across in the show also. And so head over to reliability.fm. You'll find areas for comments and suggestions and so on, and we'd love to hear from you. So with that, Andre, it's a good thing our aircraft for our recent trips actually were designed and maintained well, because we got there and back. That's right, and showed up on time. All the good things. And I know that they actually, in landing in Orlando, it was a pretty heavy wind and crosswind. And so it's like landing on an aircraft carrier not that I've ever done it, but he came in really fast and hit the ground hard and just put the plane down, as opposed to other landings where it's just a nice, soft, gentle process. But talk about variability in landing conditions. I saw that on this trip.
Yeah, and you're hoping that the landing gear is actually designed for this kind of shock.
That's right, yeah, and my seat too.
Reliably, yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, I've joked about it in the past, is being a reliability engineer makes it difficult to get on an aircraft sometimes, but it's never stopped me. It's I should worry more about getting in a car and driving on Highway 101 out here in California.
That's
where the real risk is. So with that, Andre, hopefully the rest of your day stays safe and everything around you has been designed with reliability in mind, and we'll talk to you soon.
Oh, thank you, Fred, for doing this.
All right, talk to you later.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.